This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Between the American Revolution and the Civil War, the number of slaves in the United States grew fivefold. During those decades, 1 million enslaved people were sold out of the Carolinas and the Chesapeake region, including Maryland, to vast new cotton plantations in the interior Deep South. In the 1820s, Baltimore was the biggest center of slave trading on the East Coast. Cornell University history professor Edward Baptist argues in a new book that, far from dwindling in importance during the 19th century, slavery was the driving force of the American economy, shaping it to this day. The book is called The Half Has Never Been Told, Slavery and the Making of American Capitalism. In it, he details how slavery and American capitalism were and still are inextricably bound. Professor Baptist joins us now on the line from Cornell University to talk about it. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Sheila. It's great to be here.
You write in your introduction, quote, "The idea that the commodification and suffering and forced labor of African Americans is what made the United States powerful and rich is not an idea that people necessarily are happy to hear," unquote. In brief, what is your evidence that slavery shaped the modern U.S. economy?
Well, I think the single biggest evidence is looking at the role of slavery in driving the sectors in the American economy that were the growth sectors, if you will, in the early 19th century, and specifically the export of raw cotton to the new industrial centers of the Western world, especially England, and also the development of textile industries in the United States itself. From those industries, textile industries especially, in both the U.S. and Britain, all sorts of other industries began to spin off. Now, interestingly, some of those industries found their first markets in the slave South, whether they were industries that produced consumer products for enslavers or sometimes industries that produced basic products that enslaved people used because they couldn't make them. They were too busy, in fact, making cotton.
Well, you still have to convince me. I mean, slaves were involved in producing raw products, tobacco, cotton. How can that be called industrialization?
Yeah, that's a great question. And traditionally, we've assumed, and this goes all the way back to when we started to think seriously about economics, to Adam Smith, for instance, the author or the creator of the concept of the invisible hand, for instance, and the division of labor, other sort of basic economics concepts. We've always assumed that hand labor, especially agricultural hand labor, was something that was pretty standard. It couldn't be improved. It couldn't be made more productive. And by productive, I mean producing more with the same amount of human labor in a given span of time. But what we find is that, in fact, when we look at how quickly enslaved people were picking cotton, and that was the bottleneck in the cotton production process, how quickly they were picking cotton increased three or four times over between 1800 and 1860. And this allowed factory owners in the textile-making centers of New England and England to buy cotton at a much cheaper rate, higher quality cotton, in fact. And they were able to use that margin that was provided by lowering price, the price of the raw materials, to invest in creating machines that in the factories themselves provided the same kind of productivity increases.
Well, I also think I know that during the first half of the 19th century, in this region, at any rate, around the Chesapeake, farming was changing, tobacco fields less productive, slaveholders were getting rid of slaves, sometimes letting them buy their own freedom. It doesn't sound like the institution of slavery was thriving.
It wasn't in Maryland in that sense, at any rate. But while some enslavers found that it was worth their while or maybe worth their conscience to allow manumission or allow enslaved people to purchase their own freedom, others found that it was a better deal from their perspective to cash in the human wealth that they owned under the law of slavery by selling it to slave traders. In other words, by shipping people away from their families, away from their communities, down the river, as the phrase goes, for a high price. And a pretty high price, depending on how you calculate it. Economists sometimes estimate that the price of an 18-year-old man during much of the 1800 to 1860 period was roughly equivalent to about $220,000 or $250,000 today.
So do you think the U.S. would have industrialized when we did without slavery?
That, to some extent, is a hypothetical question. It's a what if. One way to look at it is to say, if we had industrialized, and all the industrialization processes we've seen in world history over the last 200 years start with the creation of a major cotton textile producing factory sector, if we'd done that, what would we have woven instead of cotton into cloth? Because enslaved people produced cotton far more efficiently, raw cotton, than free people could. So what would we have used instead? One of the possible substitutes could have been wool, and certainly the wool industry preceded the cotton industry in Britain. It just wasn't nearly as efficient, and it didn't produce products that could be sold all over the world. But even if we'd gone in that direction, one economist calculates that we would have had to turn the entire, or the British would have had to turn the entire island of Britain into one giant sheep pasture to produce the same amount of fiber that was being imported just from Mississippi, Alabama, and Louisiana in 1830.
On WIPR, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass, speaking with Cornell University history professor Edward Baptist. We're talking about his new book, The Half Has Never Been Told, Slavery and the Making of American Capitalism. Tell us about Austin Woolfolk. He was a slave trader in Baltimore. What role did he play in the slave economy?
Yeah, we've traditionally seen slave traders as these despicable outsiders in Southern society, and I certainly am not going to argue with the despicable characterization. But instead of outsiders, I think we should see them as entrepreneurs who brought together different capabilities, different possibilities, different sources of credit, different sources of labor in a new way to allow new economic things to happen. And that shouldn't mean that we don't see them as despicable, but that we should see them as important creative forces. In particular, Austin Woolfolk makes it much easier for slave owners in Maryland to sell enslaved men and women and children to New Orleans, especially New Orleans and a few other ports, but especially New Orleans. He does that by establishing a continuous link between those two places, by advertising a sort of standard set of prices, rather than negotiating every single slave purchase he made in Maryland and then negotiating every sale he made down in New Orleans. What he did was bought slaves at a standard price in Baltimore, on the Eastern Shore, or other parts of Maryland, and shipped them down to his brothers who ran the main selling store down in New Orleans, again for a fairly standard price. And this created a kind of stable market for slaves and let slave owners know, hey, if we want to raise some cash to send our children to college, to buy some new luxuries, to make investments in other kinds of industries, we can always go to Woolfolk and we can sell slaves.
You almost make it sound the way slaveholders in this region sold slaves, you said sometimes like one or two at a time, it's almost like going to an ATM and drawing out value.
Yeah, or taking out second mortgages on homes when you know you've got a pretty solid income stream that's going to allow you to repay them. It was that sort of ability to tap into your assets that he really made possible, made very easy for Maryland slaveholders.
You write about an incident in which he beat up an abolitionist editor in Baltimore.
Yeah, this was Benjamin Lundy. Yeah. Benjamin Lundy ran a newspaper called The Genius of Universal Emancipation. And he was white, but he had become convinced that the slave trade, the domestic slave trade in particular, the trade that moved people from the upper South to the Mississippi Valley, was especially vile, sinful, and a violation of human rights. And he was continually pushed in a more radical direction by African Americans in particular. Some of his readers were African Americans, and they would come to his print shop and talk to him and try to convince him and his apprentice to move to a more radical anti-slavery position. And one day he went too far for Austin Woolfolk. He referred to Austin Woolfolk as somebody who brutally separated families and who was possibly raping the women who were passing through the jail that Woolfolk operated in downtown Baltimore. And so Woolfolk confronted him in front of his shop and beat him up. Lundy then went to court suing Woolfolk for assault and battery. And the judge conceded that, yes, this fit the legal definition of battery, but he only fined Woolfolk $1. And he gave a long speech about how the domestic slave trade was a great thing for the Maryland economy and a great thing for Maryland society in general.
Does it follow from your telling of American history that some of the wealth that has been concentrated in the hands of white citizens should be diverted to African Americans?
That's a question that keeps coming up, and I think it's a question that's going to keep coming up until certainly wealth and opportunities come into a greater balance. Currently, we see that the average white household owns $15 of assets for every $1 of assets that the average African-American household owns. And this is a pretty remarkable difference. In fact, we even see that difference at similar income levels. And I have to think that that difference has a lot to do with history, with assets that have been inherited and have largely because of restrictions on access, different kinds of segregation, whether formal or informal, have been kept among whites rather than being available to African Americans. And certainly the root of that, you know, the earliest kind of investment, if you wish, along those lines, has to be in slavery. I know not every white household obviously inherits assets that trace all the way back to slavery, but I think a lot more of us do in our society inherit assets that trace all the way back to slavery than we want to admit, because a lot of the wealth from slavery didn't just go into the South. It went into the North. It went into Britain. It went everywhere in the world economy except into the pockets and into the possession of the people who were generating it.
I really appreciate your talking to us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Edward Baptist. He's author of the new book, The Half Has Never Been Told, Slavery and the Making of American Capitalism. He'll be talking about it at noon today at the National Archives in Washington. You can stream it live. We'll have a link on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. More of this interview there, too. I'm Sheila Cast, ahead on Maryland Morning, what Francis Scott Key was up to when he wasn't writing the words of the Star-Spangled Banner. Stay with us on 88.1.